I'm reading today from Judges 16, 1-21. Samson went to Gaza, and there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her. The Gazites were told, "Samson has come here," and they surrounded the place and set an ambush for him all night at the gate of the city. They kept quiet all night, saying, "Let us wait till the light of the morning, then we'll kill him." But Samson lay till midnight, and at midnight he arose and took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and of the two posts, and then pulled them up, bar and all, and put them on his shoulders and carried them up the hill that is in front of Hebron. After this, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, "Seduce him, and see where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to humble him. And we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver." So Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me where your great strength lies and how you might be bound, that no one could subdue you." Samson said to her, "If they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings that have not been dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." Then the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings that had not been dried, and she bound him with them. Now she had men lying in ambush in an inner chamber, and she said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he snapped the bowstrings as a thread of flax snaps when it touches the fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. Then Delilah said to Samson, "Behold, you have mocked me and told me lies. Please tell me how you might be bound." And he said to her, "If they bind me with new ropes that have not been used, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." So Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them and said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And the men lying in ambush were in an inner chamber. But he snapped the ropes off his arms like a thread. Then Delilah said to Samson, "Until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you might be bound." And he said to her, "If you weave 7 locks of my head with the web and fasten it tight with the pin, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." So while he slept, Delilah took the 7 locks of his head and wove them into the web, and she made them tight with the pin, said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he woke from his sleep and pulled away the pin, the loom, and the web. And she said to him, "How can you say, 'I love you,' when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these 3 times, and you have not told me where your great strength lies." And when she pressed him hard with her words, day after day, and urged him, his soul was vexed to death. And he told her all his heart and said to her, "A razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up again, for he has told me all his heart." Then the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hands. She made him sleep on her knees, and she called a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And he woke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had left him. And the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes, and brought him down to Gaza, and bound him with bronze shackles, and he ground at the mill in the prison. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Last August, I was at the beach, and I received a phone call from a young woman, a Christian young woman, and we got to talking, and she explained to me her situation. I didn't know her. She said, you know, I've been around the village, I'm in the neighborhood, and my fiance, who I very much want to marry, is a faculty member at NYU. And we've been planning this wedding for a long time that we want to have in a few weeks from now. But because of a death in the family, we got distracted and we let things go. And now we're getting close, and we don't have anyone to marry us. So would you please marry us? And, you know, I wanted to be obliging. I just a few weeks away. So I said, yeah, maybe we could work something out. You should know that I counsel all the people I marry. So I don't marry anyone if I don't have some counseling time with them. But if our schedules work out, we can work it out. We can get together. Maybe we can do this. And so she was telling me a little bit about herself. She's a believer, a longtime believer in the Lord. And I said, tell me a little bit about your fiance. And it was an interesting cultural mix that they were having. But she said, this was all very fun conversation. And then she said, my fiance is exploring the Christian faith, but has questions about it. And when I heard that, I felt this tightness inside because I'd kind of been in this situation before. And what I realized, I was being asked very quickly to join in matrimony two people who fundamentally believed differently about the world, at least at this point. And she really wanted to marry this guy who believed differently than she did about the basic orientation of life. And I got very tight inside. It was a hard situation for me because, well, for one, you know, as a pastor, you want people to come to your church. And, you know, often getting married is a stable way for stable people to come into the church, you know. And I'm thinking, okay, here are these two that can come in. I don't want to disappoint them. Also, you know, it was hard because people who are in love are just so excited, you know, and I hate to be in a situation of pouring cold water on the fire of love. So it was hard for me. I've been in this situation before. It's no fun, but I was concerned. What could I say? What did I say? Well, I want to tell you what I said, but before I do, I want to talk to you about marriage and why I had the concern I had and what I ended up saying. Because it really is about what marriage is. What is marriage? It's a question we could study from history, because marriage has been there as long as people have been there. There's really no other custom that is so prevalent throughout time and space as marriage. Marriage has been, in one form or another, part of every culture, except perhaps one that's ever been studied or known about. It's a universal social institution around which people have organized society and their lives. Universal social institution throughout recorded history, because as far back as you go, you find people getting married. What are we to make of this? And I've been reading recently kind of evolutionary explanations for marriage as how marriage evolved. And the usual explanation that one gets, and people take this tag and say, well, it must have evolved because of some, you know, needs that were present in the population. The usual story is that women had a need to be protected, and they needed to have their offspring protected to protect the offspring, right, to preserve and propagate the genes. Men had a need and desire for sex, so there was this arrangement that developed. In exchange for protection for herself and her offspring and for getting food and game, you know, she would give intimate relations. She would give physical relations. So marriage kind of developed and evolved because of the needs of the female for protection and the sexual drive of the male, so and so. Now, friends, this fails, this explanation, for one simple reason. All primates which according to the evolutionary tree are our closest relatives, all primates organize themselves without pair bonds. That is, there's no other primate that comes together in a bond that's a pair bond, as we do in marriage. In fact, none of the animal kingdom does this. And, you know, sexual differentiation has been around for a long time. And the smallness of female, the smaller nature of females, that's been around for a long time. And yet, we have nothing even approaching this kind of need, you know, being exercised in other primates. Stephanie Kuntz, the marriage historian, she puts it this way, quote, "In fact, when you look beyond superficial similarities, we find nothing," you hear that, "nothing in the animal kingdom that remotely resembles marriage," unquote. And she's right. You know, we get kind of anthropomorphic and we see swans going across the lake and curling their necks, and we say, oh, that's just like marriage, you know, or we look at seahorses connecting, and we say, oh, that's just like marriage. No, friends, nothing like the pair bond that we have. So you look at it, no marriage at all, people, marriage. To me, friends, it's evidence of a different explanation, the explanation that the Bible gives for marriage, that it has something to do with our being created in the image of God, that we have the ability to marry because of the way that we're made in God's image. To me, much more reasonable explanation. So I want to look and think with you about marriage and romantic relationships and close relationships this morning. When I think about how to do that with you or where to go, I can really think of no better place to do that than Judges chapter 16. So I wonder if you would look with me this morning at marriage, at close relationships in Judges chapter 16, the story, really the second half of the story of Samson. And we're going to look at what relationships do, because it brings it out so well. Let me try to show you what I mean. In the first three verses, as we have here, we are rejoining Samson at this latter stage of his life, this latter period of his life. And the first three verses of this chapter let us know where Samson is now. Okay, so we're rejoining Samson. This is the third chapter into his life we have. So it gives us kind of an update. This is where things stand with Samson. This is what his life is like now, these first three verses. And the first thing we note from verse 1 is that he's in Gaza, which is far away. Gaza was the southernmost city of the great Philistine Pentapolis. There were these five great cities that constituted the kingdom, the nation of the Philistines, these Greeks that had come over by sea. And Gaza was the farthest one down. You can, you know, even today, Gaza is the one way down there, and that's why there's all this question about the Egypt and, you know, what's coming in through Gaza and things. So Gaza was the farthest city south. I think that's symbolic also of where Samson is spiritually, because he's the farthest away from the kingdom of heaven. He's farthest away from the kingdom that God is building. And in the same way, geographically, he's farthest away from the tribes, from Judah and from Ephraim and all the rest of the tribes up north in Palestine. So he's the farthest he's ever been, really, spiritually, from the kingdom. What do we find him doing in these verses? He's still doing whatever he wants to do. You know, he finds these folks in waiting, these guys who are going to kill him, and he just gets angry at them. So he picks up the gates, and he pulls them out, and you know, no one could really carry these gates. They're just massive gates, and he picks them, and he carries them 40 miles. And not just 40 straight miles, he carries them up in elevation to around Hebron. So he's going up about 2,000 feet in elevation while he's going this 40 miles. He takes these gates and he rams them down in the hill opposite Hebron, probably out of spite, to the Judahites, who in an earlier episode in his life handed him over to the Philistines. So you could see this scene. He goes up and right across from their main city of Hebron, bam, bands rams down the gates in front of them, as if to say, na 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 na, you know. It's probably out of spite to the Judahites. Still doing whatever he wants to do from base motives. Still inciting the Philistines by these kind of hit-and-run episodes rather than actually fighting them. Rather than actually leading the Israelites into battle against the oppressors and throwing off the oppression. Instead of leading into war, he does these hit-and-run acts when it suits him. For whatever emotions he happens to be feeling. So friends, Samson has found that something that others have found, that it's actually much easier to be a gifted outlaw than to be an actual leader. You know, it's much easier to take your gifts and just do hit and run when you feel like it, than to actually take on the mantle of leadership and lead and do what God has called you to do when he gifts you to lead. But it's much easier to just live this way. And so that's the way he's living. And so in doing this, inciting the Philistines, he's developed this reputation stretching all the way down to Gaza. And he accumulates this bounty on his head, this enormous bounty on his head. You can tell that by this point, the Philistines are fed up. They want vengeance. And so you could just picture the posters going up all around the Pentapolis, you know, wanted, dead or alive. Have you seen this man? Here, boom, image of Samson there. So he's a wanted man. Samson doesn't care because he just figures God will always be there anyway. Things aren't going to change. So this is Samson's life right now, as we join him in the story. For our purposes today, I want us to especially see that Samson at this point has become very cynical about love. And you could see his cynicism. He's had relationships now in the past that did not work at all. At one point, he even tried marriage, and that was a complete fiasco. You know, he said at one point, he gave this paltry effort to say, well, let me try to do it right at one point. But that was a disaster. And so what do you see now? You see him hardening towards women. And this is so true, friends. If you meet divorced people are some of the most traumatized people that you are going to meet. Because something often has been lost in their psyche. You know, I don't get it when people say about the Bible, oh, it's so irrelevant. You know, it's this outdated book. It doesn't apply today. Friends, this is exactly what it looks like. This is so relevant. Samson doesn't care. He's hardened. And so now he's all about the casual fling. That's what he's about. He's done with this romantic view of happily ever after, but he still needed sex, so, you know, whatever. This girl looked good, and so, verse 1, he went into her. And that's the way he's living his life. He's going to go to bed with women, but he is certainly not going to wake up with women. He's not going to wake up with this girl. No way. So what do you see him do? He gets up at midnight and leaves. Why? Because you don't want to wake up with a girl in the morning. That's when things get weird, right? That's when they want to maybe cuddle or have coffee with you or, you know, set up another date. No, he didn't want any of that. That's not going to happen. So he's gone at midnight, right? This is Samson's love life now. You see it? You see it? This is Samson disdaining relationships. The kind of relationships that God would have for us, the long-term committed relationships. This is his disdain for it. That's where he's at. But, verse 4, relationships have a way of creeping up on us. And so before you know it, verse 4, he's in love with this woman from the Valley of Sorek, and her name is Delilah. Now, friends, those of us who have been reading the book of Judges, I hope that you have been, and I hope that you found it useful to understand the structure of the book, its chiastic structure, because it helps us to make comparisons, does it not? And we realize that on one side of the book, there are comparisons to the other side of the book, and Samson, the last judge, is being compared to who? Remember the first judge, Othniel, not a name that you might remember, but the first judge was the best judge, overcoming probably the greatest enemy at that time. In the beginning, it was the best judge. The last judge we see is Samson, and he's probably the worst judge. You know, both these guys had faith. Both of them had ability, both did some damage, but Othniel led against the most powerful enemy. Samson won't even get it together to lead against the Philistines on the coast. So we're seeing this comparison between these judges, and it invites us, friends, if we're comparing Othniel and Samson, to indeed also compare their wives. Because, you know, there are only two women in the book of Judges, and there are only two wives who are named of Judges in the book of Judges. That's the wife of Othniel, Aksa, and the wife of Samson, Delilah. And, you know, I say wife. He was done with the marriage thing, but it's pretty much becomes his wife, right? Common law wife. And so these are the two partners of Judges that are named, the only two in the book. They kind of invite, the author is inviting us to compare them. And you compare them, you see the real contrast between these two women. One comes from the high country around Hebron, actually where Samson ended up planting those gates. The other one comes from the low country, from this valley of Sorek, which is a wadi that is going to the west from the mountains down into the floodplain. The southern coast, and they're both they're coming from these different areas, but they're both pressing their men. You read the stories, you realize that they both press their husbands, but one of them presses him for God's purposes, the other one presses him for her own purposes, to control him. So there's a very clear contrast between these two partners. And you know, when I bring up this parallel, I'm thinking about these things in the phone call that I was having last August at the beach. I just want to say that you know, this guy that she was describing to me, this young woman, he seemed like a great guy. And so in making this parallel that I'm making, I don't mean to imply that this guy was like Delilah, you know, for her, that he had base motives in marrying her. But there are things that happen in relationships, in all relationships over time, that was my concern. So the reason I'm bringing us to this passage this morning is to see those things in relationship. Even though this guy seemed like a nice guy, I'm not trying to imply that he was the same as Delilah, but it's important to understand what relationships do. And I'm going to give you three things this morning that relationships do in the time that we have this morning from this passage. It's very, very demonstrative, this whole series of interchanges between Samson and Delilah. So let's look at those three things that relationships do. And the reason why we need to choose carefully when we choose someone to be in relationship with, in romantic relationship with. The first thing that a relationship will do is that it will reveal your strength, the strengths that you have, and the secret of those strengths. You see in verse 9, there's a phrase that's used throughout the passage, and here it is in verse 9, the secret of his strength, which at that point was not known. And this is what relationships will do. They will reveal your strengths. They reveal the strengths of your partner. Kay Lawson Younger, a commentator, he asks a question, very insightful question. He said, what do you think that Samson actually looked like? What do you think that Samson probably looked like? And he gives a very thoughtful answer, I think a very convincing answer, that he probably was pretty normal looking. You know, when we think of Samson, we picture this guy under the arch, you know, making muscles. You know, we're thinking pro wrestling, right? Yeah, Samson, right? That's what we picture in our mind. I don't know, that's what I picture. That's what we picture in our mind. We picture this Hulk. We picture this behemoth guy with all these muscles. Well, you know, Younger points out that if that was what he actually looked like, then why would all these people be trying to figure out what the secret of his strength was? Right? If he was a behemoth, it would be obvious what his strength was. So Younger makes the point, I think, the right point, that he was actually probably pretty normal looking, this Samson character, because the secret of his strength was not known. It wasn't obvious. How people just looked at what he did and he said, how are you doing these things? And somehow strength was coming from somewhere else. So this is a good thing for us to consider, friends, as we look and think about relationships, because this is what relationships do. They bring out things that aren't seen by other people. They bring out the strengths that aren't seen by other people. And this is what happens to you in a relationship. When, you know, as you experience, you get into a relationship, as you experience the astonishment that someone might actually love you, as that's going out, there are certain things that happen to you inside, and your strengths come out. And it's not necessarily the strengths that everyone else sees. They saw a certain Samson. They didn't understand what was going on or where these things were coming from. But an intimate relationship brings out the source of your strengths. What makes you who you are, that's what comes out. And this is an involved affair. It happens over a period of time. Doesn't happen easily. And it doesn't happen because initially there are kind of false pictures in any relationship. And actually you see it in this relationship too. There are these false answers that come out. Well, maybe not entirely false, but what I call diverting layers aren't really the truth about Samson, but they are the things that have come out in their exchanges, in their conversation. Bowstrings, ropes, not really. That's not really what it's about. But, you know, this is the things that come out in the initial layers. And so when I have engaged couples come in, and engaged couples are usually very excited, and they say, you know, we're just telling each other everything. We know everything about each other. I say, not really. I don't say that because, you know, I don't enjoy pouring water on fire, friends. I don't enjoy being in that position. And actually what's going on is usually terrific. So I don't want to spoil what the great things that are going on. But actually, they need to come to understand. They shouldn't mistake the nice things that are going on, the ways in which they're coming to know certain things as really knowing the other person. They can't mistake that for what's going on. Really going through the layers till you get to what really makes somebody work. And really through that, coming to appreciate the person's genuine strengths. You know, what their strengths are. This is what happens in a relationship as time goes on. It's not these kind of diverting layers in the beginning. But with time, it is revealed to us. Unfortunately, in this relationship, in this deepening relationship, in this story, what we see is along with the revelation of strengths comes a widening chasm of trust. And when the relationships are not working well, those things are going on at the same time. There's distrust coming in while the relationship, while the strengths are getting revealed. And that brings us to the second thing that relationships do. Okay, not only reveals their strengths, but number two, it will reveal where you are vulnerable. Relationships with time will reveal where someone is vulnerable. Not always most obvious with a guy, but it will happen eventually. And we see, you know, we see it happen progressively, actually, in this passage. In verse 13, well, he gets to the bowstrings, you know, not too much there, but so verse 13, he says, the hair. Before that, there's these ropes. You know, it's not really the ropes, but the never been used part. There's some truth in that. It's just got to go deeper. And then in verse 13, you know, he starts talking about, it comes out, it has something to do with his hair. So you see these kind of getting deeper and deeper and closer to the truth. It wasn't wet flax, but then you're getting to the hair and you're starting to realize it's something about this hair. And then, you know, finally it comes out. You know, and I know that when you read this passage, you're probably thinking, Samson is just stupid, right? I mean, she goes through these things. How can you be made weak? And then he tells her, and then she does it to him. And she does it three times. We don't know if the guys in the back room ever came out or not, if that was revealed. But, you know, couldn't he get a clue? You're probably reading this and you're thinking, boy, this is just stupid. This Samson is just stupid. Friends, he's not stupid. He's in love. Now, which one of you is being unrealistic here, irrelevant? Is it the Bible or is it you? He's not stupid. He's just in love. And this is why I don't get it when people say the Bible is so irrelevant. This is exactly how it is. And, you know, the outsiders can certainly see it. People look in the relationship from the outside and they say, why does she let him treat her that way? Or why does he allow her to do that? And blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's clear to us, but it's not clear to them. Why? Because of what's going on in the relationship. So, yeah, it's coming out and it's getting closer and closer to the truth. And Samson is just, you know, Samson, he's a risk taker. He likes living on the edge, like many men do. They just very comfortable with a lot of risk. Samson likes living that way. Though the point of a marriage relationship for men like that is to actually harness that risk taking. They're actually good. There's a very good part to that risk taking. It just needs to be harnessed. It can't be used as it's being here for pride or vengeance. It has its place, just not here. And so, verse 17, the truth finally comes out. And what is it? He told her all his heart. A razor has never come upon my head because I've been a Nazarite from before I was born. I hope that you can appreciate the pain that must have been in this conversation present for Samson. You realize for Samson, this is a very painful thing to finally say. Probably hasn't said it to anybody. Probably very few people actually know. But this sacred truth finally comes out. I've been a Nazarite since before I was born. And you realize that this is the piece of him that he has not let go of. That this is the last piece of him that's left in the life that should have been devoted to God. There's the one thing that he's held on to. You know, all the other Nazarite vows, all the other Nazarite rules of devotion, he has completely violated and trampled upon. But there's this one thing of being a Nazarite, of being devoted to God, that he has not done. He has not cut his hair. It's the only thing left between him and God. The only thing that he hasn't let go of yet. It wasn't the hair. It was the Nazarite devotion to God. It was the vow of being devoted to God. And he knows that his life is not that way. It's not the life that it should have been. And this is the core part of him. Now, friends, when you're in an intimate relationship and you get to this point, it's very important how your partner responds to you. Because usually, when you come to this point where you're most vulnerable, it's also the point where you're the most unreasonable. It's usually the thing that is just the most unreasonable about you. How do you respond when you find out where your partner is unreasonable and vulnerable? Do you say, "You are a strange beast from another planet"? Or do you say, "I will make a place for that in my life. I will see it as my job to accommodate the vulnerability in you"? And don't underestimate how hard that is to do in marriage. What do you say? Do you say, "Not cutting your hair, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. You got to join the real world, Sammy baby"? You say something like that? Or do you instead say, "This is a strange thing to me that you're telling me, but I can see it. I can see how this is actually all tied up with your relationship with God. I can see it, that this is the issue for you. And you know what, Samson? I will make sure that your hair never gets cut." So you see, the right spouse, the spouse that would have been from the hill country around Hebron, the right spouse would have seen that, would have called him to that, would have found out eventually that this is what it's about, and would have directed him and enabled him to go in the direction that he should go. It would have called him to answer his calling and would have helped him get there. But instead, this revelation comes to Delilah, who uses it to torment him. And this seems very strange to me, but as I read this, doesn't it seem to you that she's tormenting him in his sleep? She torments him, and then verse 20, that's when he wakes. So it almost seems like she's tormenting him in his sleep. I don't understand. It's a very strange situation. I don't know if she's afraid of him or what. But whatever it is, it results in torment. Friends, here's the main point, is that an intimate relationship will reveal where you're vulnerable. And Samson finally reaches that point of surrender of the last part of himself that belonged to God, and he surrenders it to Delilah. Now, are you ready to do that? Are you sure that you are going to be with a person who can caretake that? Someone who, even though it's strange, that deep part of you, can understand how your vulnerability is really your need for your Lord, and can help you there. Now, if you have someone who believes completely differently than you do, they might be able to support your faith and say, I support this person's faith, even though I don't share that. They might be able to say that to you starting out, but it's not the same thing when it gets to this point. It's not the same thing that you both need. So what your spouse does with your vulnerabilities makes all the difference in the world. And that brings us to the third thing that relationships do. Over time, most importantly, number three, is that relationships will eventually show the different motivations that are there in you. In verse 5, back in verse 5, we get really an insight into Delilah's motivations. We get to see, Samson doesn't get to see. And the Philistine lords come to her and say, we will give you 1,100 shekels of silver each. Each. There were five of them. 5,500 shekels of silver. Friends, that's an absurd amount of money. So we're not talking about just a, you know, a nice payoff on the side. We're talking about being set for life. Not your life, just your life, your family's life, your children's life, your third and fourth generation. This was the jackpot. This was hitting the lottery. So what we're talking about here is Delilah's security, what she's going to base her life on. And you see, in the end, what she's going to base her life on is different than what Samson needs to base his life on. Now, these motivations of what people are really living their life for, they don't come out in the beginning, because there are a lot of things at the beginning of a relationship that will obscure that. You know, in the beginning, and not bad things, good things. We love the same things. We love to do the same things together. That's a good thing, but you know what? It kind of obscures what a person's deep motivations are, right? Or their sexual attraction, another very good thing. Kind of obscures the motivations that come out over time. Or you might have the same kind of dreams of basically your life, of having, maybe you will both want to have really successful children. And that can obscure motivations for a while, make you seem like you're on the same track. But what is really revealed in your hearts is only revealed over time, through time. This is something that the Bible has preached for thousands of years and people have ignored. That one of the biggest things that your marriage will do to you is that it will change your goals. It will, because you will have goals that come together with the other person. And it doesn't matter whether you're complementarian or egalitarian or dictatorial. It doesn't matter. Your partner's goals are going to affect yours. And they're going to be a hindrance or a help. They're just going to be this new thing forged together. So that is why the Bible tells us to choose well if you're in a position to choose. What is it that happens if you find out you're really motivated by different forces? Well, in this story we read about in verse 20 through 21, it's very tragic. First thing that happens for Samson is this humiliation. You know, the millstone I find very significant. He's grinding at the millstone. And the millstone appears in this book in an earlier story as a principal thing in the hands of a woman. Because in those days, the grinding of the grain, using of the millstone, was the woman's work. So, you know, the Philistines are humiliating him here. It's kind of ironic that he's overcome by this woman. All of his strength was nothing, no avail by this woman. And so now they're putting him in the place of this woman. But, you know, worse than the humiliation let us realize, friends, that the author is trying to tell the Israelites of his time, he's trying to give them a message for themselves in this story. And the original audience, I think probably Saul's, during the reign of King Saul, would be reading this, and the message that would be coming across from the author is, you know, you think that things are always going to continue on the way that they are because you're you, right? Because you're the chosen ones. You're the chosen people. And so God's never going to be apart from you. You'll never come to a point where you'll see God isn't there. The author of this story is trying to send a message to the Israelites of that time that if they continue in their lethargy and their syncretism, they will be sorely mistaken about that point. That if they break the covenant, then the covenant gets broken. And who exactly is the chosen in the covenant becomes very unclear. They didn't think that God could possibly leave him. And then this is the worst thing about what this relationship does to Samson. You see that? It couldn't be more poignant in verse 21. He awakens. And he thought that God was still with him. He thought that that would never change. But what which he thought could not happen, happened to him in his relationship. God left him. So all of these things and these ideas were going around in my head when I was on the phone in August at the beach. And you know what I said to her? I said, you know what I would very much like to do? You know, you both sound just terrific. I would love to meet your fiancé. Love to sit down, talk with him, and explore the possibility that he could be introduced to Jesus Christ. And I would do that at your convenience. But I cannot go forward on your time frame here and agree to marry you. Things just need to slow down. Because of what I know marriage is, I cannot put you in that danger. This is a Christian believer I'm talking to. Even though he's a great guy, there are just things that have to be revealed over time. And that may show you're on very different paths. So I said something like this to her. And it was a very friendly conversation. But I never heard from her again after that. So I wish her well. You know, when we talk about love, friends, what are we actually talking about? When we talk about these things that relationship does, you realize what we're talking about is the coming to know of another and the trust that goes along with that. And you realize what we're doing, this process of coming to know, this process of knowing and trusting and intimacy, we're talking about the relationship within God's own triune self. That's where this comes from. You know, the New Testament tells us there are some very deep things about God, but there's only one who really knows the deep things of God, and that's Holy Spirit. Only Holy Spirit knows the very deep things of God that others don't. We don't. So you see, in saying that, what the New Testament is saying is that this is the intimacy is an experience of God. And marriage, when it works out, is showing us Trinity, you know. And we see that to the degree that we can see relationship between the members of the Trinity. We can see that. I mean, we only see their relationship as it relates to us and what they do for us and to us. But we see it in that, you know, the members of the Trinity, the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, are first, second, and third. Members of the Trinity. You watch them, in a way, you can see them interact in the plan of salvation. The second knew the strengths of the first and empowered the strengths of the first in the planning of salvation. The first knew and cultivated the second, cultivated the strengths of the second, the Christ. What were the strengths of the Christ? It was being the Word. It was being out into the world. And so in the plan of salvation, the first sent the second out into the world. And when he did, the second shone. The second was in his element in coming. And the second he just flourished. Christ just flourished in this plan. And the second did what he did to lift up and promote the first. The second knew where the first really cared, the things that he really cared about. And so one of those things, for example, the temple, being the temple. When the temple was desecrated, the second went ballistic. You know, when Jesus cleansed the temple, that was primarily it was an interaction between members of the Trinity going on there. That's what it was, first of all. Do you realize what accomplished your salvation? What accomplished your salvation is this third point about what relationships do. It reveals those motivations, and what was revealed is that the motivations of the first and the second were the same. And that is the only reason that you could be sitting here today. Only reason that there could be a plan of salvation is because the first and the second agreed on what should be done, on what needed to be done. That is why you're here, because they had a good marriage, so to speak. It's because they agreed together in themselves. Friends, the Lord this morning invites us into his love. He invites us into that intimacy. And you know what? You don't have to be married to enjoy that. Christ and the Father invite us to his table here. And in that table, we experience the intimacy of God's love. And he invites us into it. It's the most beautiful thing for us to be a part of what goes on between God. So I want to invite you to come forward. Come show him that you want the same things that he wants by joining him at his table. Let's stand.